Thank you for being in our assembly to worship God with us. We're using our Sunday evenings to go through the Gospel of John. Tonight we're in John chapter 5, verses 16 through 24. If you have your New Testament handy, we'll be able to look with us at this passage as we consider what John is telling us in his record of the good news. We have to make the point that the miracle that we just read about in the previous few verses was very definitely a sign by Jesus that he is indeed the representative of God that God's people had waited for hundreds of years. When we read sometimes of the miracles that the Lord performed, and particularly when we read about the healing of a man who was lame, a lot of times we don't pay attention or remember what the prophets had said would be characteristic of the new age that God would bring in. For example, Isaiah said in Isaiah 35 and verse 6, "Then the lame will leap like a deer." And that's probably exactly what happens when a lame person is healed by a touch or by a word of Jesus during his ministry on this earth. And the record says, at least in one instance, as I recall, one who healed leapt. He jumped in the air. It was Jeremiah's vision that the blind and the lame would be gathered in together in God's new Zion in Jeremiah 31, verses 8 and 9. So, when we read about the miracles in the New Testament, it's very helpful for us to put those in their proper setting if we're a little bit familiar with the Old Testament scriptures. And I say that to raise this question. Do you think that the Jews during the time of Jesus were familiar with the Old Testament scriptures? And when they observed the miracles, the signs that he did, you know, why do the inspired writers refer to them as signs? Do you think that they saw a connection between what they read previously in the Holy Scriptures about the lame would leap like a deer, the blind would receive their sight, the sick would be healed, passages like that? So, if you were a Jew in the setting of this time, and Jesus does this miracle and you're an eyewitness to it, and then he talks to you and says words that bring to your mind the concept of God's Messiah in reference to himself, what would your reaction be, you think? Would it be at long last the waited Messiah that we've been waiting for? Or would it be, well, you don't measure my concept of who the Messiah is, and so I reject you. And that was a struggle in the Jewish mind at that particular time. But the signs that Jesus did would make it crystal clear to any Jew who was brought up with his parents teaching in the scriptures that his claim was that he's the representative of God. He is the Messiah. He is the Christ. He's claiming rights that belong to God alone. He was declaring that the things which marked the dawn of this new age, this new kingdom that God would usher in, had begun to happen among God's people right now. He's claiming functions and privileges and powers that belong to the Messiah and no one else. This passage is nothing else than a series of very deliberate claims to be the Messiah. We might ask ourselves, would we have the courage to do that? Would we have the courage to go against the grain of religious society with the truth? And that's what Jesus did when he claimed to be the Messiah. Certainly it's an act of, of the most extraordinary and the most unique courage. Jesus must have known well that to speak like he's going to speak would sound like blasphemy in the ears of the Orthodox Jews. He must have known that to speak like this is going to be to court death, and at the very least, suffering and persecution. It is his claim to be king. And he knew very well that the man who listened to these words would have only two alternatives. Number one, he could accept what Jesus is saying about himself, along with its attendant persecution by the Jewish religious establishment. Or secondly, he could reject belief in Christ and continue to look for the Messiah of his own concept, reject Jesus as a blasphemer, reject Jesus as a crazy man who's speaking out of his head, and seek to destroy him. Those would be the two alternatives, wouldn't they? Look with me in verse 16. For this reason, the healing of this man on the Sabbath day, for this reason the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. They were filled with contempt. They were persecuting Jesus. They sought opportunities to persecute Jesus, and they sought opportunities ultimately to put him to death because he violated their concepts of what the Sabbath was all about. And they encouraged all other people to whom they could gain their ears to ignore this man, to reject this man, to be opposed to this man. So by the time it's time for Jesus' crucifixion, it's no surprise to us that there were crowds of people hollering, "Crucify! Crucify!" That's not a surprise. Recall that Sabbath breaking among the Jews was a capital offense. You break the Sabbath day, you are stoned to death. That's the punishment. So you think you would be in a society where it'd be pretty strict observance of the Sabbath day? And it was their chance to apply this death penalty to Jesus. It's shocking to us that their unscriptural Sabbath regulations were so very important to them that they would even put the Son of God to death, clinging to those man-made traditions. That raises a question with us. How strong do you think human religious traditions are in the minds of people? How strong can they be? Strong enough to kill someone who opposes you for upholding those traditions? It's a warning for us. Do not allow your desire to hold on to your personal beliefs that are based on tradition to cause you to reject the Christ and his word in favor of error. That's a practical application and warning for us. In verse 17, Jesus answered these people and he said, "My Father is working until now, and I myself am working." The first thing that may be somewhat shocking to his listeners is he calls God his own Father. He claimed a unique relationship between himself and God. And this is what the religious leaders were unprepared to accept. They wouldn't accept that from anybody. Jesus' defense was wholly shattering to these men. His defense is, God doesn't stop working on the Sabbath day. Therefore, I do not either. Think about that a little bit. What sort of work would God do on the Sabbath day? He's saying if the Sabbath day is broken, God's breaking it. And I'm with God. God continues his providence. He continues his mercy to men. He continues his compassion to men on the Sabbath day. He stopped creation on the seventh day. But he didn't stop his existence. And his essence and his character and what flows out of that to benefit man wherever they are and under whatever conditions they live. So even on the Sabbath day, God's love is shown to man. His mercy, his compassion. And so it is with Christ. To the Jews, this statement meant nothing less than the work of Jesus and the work of God are exactly the same. That's how they took it. That's what Jesus is saying. And to them, it seemed like Jesus is putting himself on an equality with God, and we can't abide that. We can't take that. We can't accept that. Here's a lesson for us. The compassion of the Christian must be just like the compassion of God. Available to be shown at all times, to all people, whenever we find a situation where God's compassion could shine to them, where they could see the life of Christ in us, where they could see the love of God in us, where they could see His mercy, His unending and unceasing mercy to man. People must see it in us. Other work may be laid aside. But the work of loving other people and the work of showing compassion to other people can never be laid aside. Not on any day of the week. In verse 18, for this reason, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him. Because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, but he was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. The Jews at least understood something that people today don't understand, I think. That Jesus claimed to be deity. He's saying, I am divine. I am Godhood. God is my Father. When He works, I work. When He speaks, I speak. He's saying I'm equal to God. The Jews understand that. A lot of people in our own society don't. And people are saying things in our society like Jesus never claimed to be deity. Really? And these Jews understood what he said, and they concluded he's making himself equal with God. Now, if that wasn't the correct conclusion, why didn't Jesus say, wait a minute, you've misunderstood me. I'm not going that far. I'm not making that claim. But Jesus never says anything like that. He continues saying things to lead them to conclude he's exactly who God sent into this world. He is the Messiah. Do you find that interesting? I do. In John 8 and verse 58, Jesus said, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. Not I was. Not before Abraham was born, I was born. Before Abraham was born, I am. I exist. I am in the present. What he's saying is, he's eternal. In John 10, 30 and through 33, Jesus said very clearly, I and the Father are one. Notice the reaction of the Jews. Are they misunderstanding something here? And does Jesus stop and say, well, wait a minute, I didn't mean what you think I mean by that. They took up stones again to stone him. And Jesus says to that, not, wait a minute, you're mistaken, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. He says, I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you stoning me? Does that sound like somebody that's backing up on a claim to be the Messiah? Who is trying to erase what he had just said about himself? The Jews answered him, "For a good work, we do not stone you, but for blasphemy." And notice how they explain the blasphemy. "But, and because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God." They clearly understood what Jesus was claiming about himself. And John, through his gospel, keeps indicating to us over and over this growing irrational hostility of Jewish people claiming to be followers of God, that they're showing to Jesus, that will ultimately lead to his crucifixion on the cross. They began to persecute Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath day, but also the confrontation between the Jews and Jesus that erupted because of this event set the stage for Jesus to make some of the very strongest statements about his identity and his deity in the Bible in verses 17 through 47. His own unity with the Father, his divine commission, his authority, and proofs of his Messiahship. There's a lesson in there for you and I. Christ's amazing claims to be divine, to be God, deserve our honor and our respect and our recognition. So much so that we'll even alter our personal lifestyle to conform to an image that honors him. Don't you think? In verse 19, "Therefore Jesus answered and was saying to them, Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing. For in whatever the Father does, these things the Son also does in like manner." So here's the beginning of Jesus' answer to the Jews regarding the charge that he's making himself equal with God. The Son does only what he sees the Father doing. Would you expect the Messiah to say that? Whoever the Messiah is, even if it's not Jesus, even if it's somebody later, wouldn't you expect him to say, "The Messiah does only what the Father does"? The Messiah says only what the Father tells him to say. Wouldn't you expect that? To see Jesus in action is to see God in action. That's what he's saying. The things that God does are the things that Jesus does. The things that Jesus does are the things that God does. The great prominent truth about Jesus is this. When we look at Jesus, we see God. We understand God by looking at Jesus. We hear God when we hear Jesus. We love God when we love Jesus. We live the way God wants us to live when we live the way that Jesus tells us to live. When we see Jesus, we see God. If we wish to see how God feels about men, and if we wish to see how God reacts to sin, and if we wish to see how God regards the human situation, we look at Jesus. And we get the answers. They're the same. The mind of Jesus is the mind of God. The words of Jesus are the words of God. The actions of Jesus are the actions of God. Further, Jesus does not do anything which proceeds from himself. Whatever he does proceeds from God. I do only what God tells me to do. I do only what God shows me to do. I show you only what God shows me to show you. Boy, that's a perfect unity in every respect, isn't it? I and my Father are one. Of course you are. Of course you are. You're so united that everything the Father tells you, you tell other people. Everything the Father shows you, you show other people. You don't leave anything out. You don't add anything to it. You don't alter it. You don't change it. You don't corrupt it. It's all the same. When you see Jesus, you see the Father. That's the one primary truth of this particular section. The will of Jesus is completely submitted to the will of God. What is His wish for man? The will of Jesus is completely submissive to the will of God. You know what that says to a disciple, to a learner of Christ, a follower of Christ? Does it tell us something about what we need to do with our will? The perfect unity of the Father and Son is clear in the Lord's statement. Jesus duplicated and continued to do the Father's works. And here's a lesson for us. You and I should seek to imitate in every way possible. In every way possible, our Lord Jesus. We need to do the things that He does. We need to say the things that He says. We need to have the heart that He has. We need to have the will that He has. We need to have the courage that He has. Everything about Him, we love and appreciate to the extent we want it. Give it to me. I'm seeking for it. I'm hungry for it. I want to be what you are. And sometimes I fall miserably short of that. Do you have that struggle with your own personal will? But we should imitate our Lord in every possible way that we can. To love as He loved. To obey as He obeyed. To do good to others as He did good to others. To be willing to sacrifice as He was willing to sacrifice. And to suffer for righteousness as He was willing to suffer for righteousness. And on we could go. Jesus is to God as we must be to Jesus. Think about that a little bit. In verse 20, we're told the great motivation behind that. For the Father loves the Son and shows Him all things that He Himself is doing. And the Father will show Him greater works than these, so that you will marvel. This unity that we're talking about between the Father and the Son is seen in its greatest picture in the concept of love. Why are they so united? Jesus answers that question in explanation to what He's saying right here. The Father loves the Son, and He shows Him everything. The Father loves the Son. The love between Father and Son is so intimate and so close that to look at Jesus is to see God. There is such a complete understanding, such a complete identity of the mind, identity of the will, identity of the heart, that the Father and Son are one. The harmony of action between them that Jesus has described is accomplished not as some people have supposed it to be, who are really wrong about it. They say the only way it's possible for there to be that complete harmony and unity between the Father and the Son is this. They're one person. They're the same person. Now, in the human way of thinking, with human beings, that might be true. The only way you're a perfect duplicate of someone else is you're the same person. You think the same. You say the same things. you do the same things. We have to be the same person. God doesn't exist because of man's rules and man's way of thinking, though, does he? So aside from what schismatics say about Jesus and the Father, the only way to explain that is they're one person. No, they're not. Christ himself explains it on the basis of this. It's the love that the Father has for the Son. That's how it's explained. And that calls attention to the great concept of love with God. And you and I need to learn more about that. Even when we think we know it all, we still need to learn more about that. I think we sing a song sometimes, don't we, about never being able to fathom the full, unexhaustible concept of the powerful magnitude of God's great love. Maybe it's not exactly in those words, but something like that. This love moves the Father not only to reveal His will to the Son, but to work through Him to disrupt the laws of nature that He's put in place such that when the laws of nature are disrupted, people will pay attention to that and they'll regard that as a sign from heaven. And hopefully they'll draw the right conclusion. God is above men. Unless they're too wrapped up in their own traditions and the extension of their own fiefdom, power, kingdom. You think? What would you say that Jesus has complete confidence in? When he's saying these words, knowing that they're not going to accept them. Who does Jesus have complete confidence in? He's quite sure that what men were seeing then was only the beginning. And he's quite certain that they would see even greater things than what they had seen up to this point in time. Even greater works than these miracles would be done by him when he brought to life people who are dead, for one thing. Although physical resurrection is included in this context, maybe the greater works that he refers to here, maybe he meant that these were powers that Jesus is going to demonstrate by granting everlasting life to believers and by executing a punishment of judgment and condemnation to those who don't believe. Those would be greater works, wouldn't they? So the forces of Jewish religion were gathering together and piling together and whispering together about what they wanted to do to Jesus, and it's going to end up in his crucifixion. But Jesus was quite certain that the future was in the hands of God and not men. Would you say he was confident in the Father? He didn't fear anything that men would do to him. You and I might be running for cover. You and I might not be bold enough to make the claims that he made in the face of such opposition. And it's powerful opposition. Would you say he was confident in the Father? Or would you say he entertained doubts within his own mind, thinking, well, God may not really be able to pull this off because of the opposition? I think I'll go with confidence. Won't you? Jesus was confident in his Father. Now let me ask you this, as a parallel to, would you say that Jesus was confident in his Father? Would you say that Jesus was a fearless person? Would you say he demonstrated great moral courage when he stood up in opposition of his own brethren and said, you misunderstand the scriptures. This is what God means, and this is what God says to you. And you're not quite right, even though you think you are. takes a great amount of courage to do that, doesn't it? Would you think he was certain that he would be misunderstood by the Jewish authorities? And would you say he was fearless? Would you say that his words, he understood that his words would just set them afire? That he would inflame the minds of his hearers and endanger his own life beyond anything he could say by what he said? Would you say that? And if you think that may have been the case, there's no situation in which Jesus would lower his claims or adulterate the truth or corrupt the truth by backing away and saying, no, that you're misunderstanding me. That's not really what I meant. He would make his claim and he would speak the truth no matter what men would do in reaction to it. And boy, that takes a powerful amount of courage, doesn't it? But it also takes a powerful amount of confidence in his Father. Maybe you and I need a little more confidence in our Father. Maybe you and I need to be a little bit more fearless when it comes to standing up for the truth. Do you think that might be a lesson we could take away from this? To love the Father and love the Son the way the Son loves the Father and the Father loves the Son? Could we take that away? To Jesus, it was much more important to be true to God than respect or fear men. Do you think we could benefit by feeling that same way? I've mentioned this to you before, but I want to remind you of it again, and it's a personal thing with me. One of my greatest personal challenge. If you want to know who I am, what I'm really all about, here it is. My greatest challenge as a Christian is in this verse right here in Mark 12, verse 30. Where Jesus said, you'll love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. That's the way Jesus loved the Father. But when I look at myself, I see somebody that doesn't measure up. And I can't be content about that, and I can't be happy about it. That's a challenge for me. We should have complete confidence in the Father and the Son, and we should live fearlessly for the Father and the Son. And we don't need to turn the wisdom of the world into the great answer book that we seek out when we have trials and difficulties in life. We need to love our Father. He loves us. Maybe that's a good place to stop. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it so much. I'm trying very hard to try to put myself in the position of the Jews in the first century who are listening to Jesus and how they must have felt. It's easy for us sometimes to look at the Jews and maybe think wrong things about them because they did end up rejecting Christ. But many of them were trying to do right. Trying to please God. They're just living under vastly different circumstances than the culture of America and the time we live. John has so much to say in his gospel to all of those who read his gospel up until the end of time. So much to help us understand. So much to encourage us to think the right way, do the right thing. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind. Thanks so much for listening tonight. If you're in our assembly, and the invitation of the Lord is certainly open to everyone. you're in our assembly and you're not a Christian. We can't hide the fact that it's going to cost you something to be a Christian. That'd be unfair to you. Because what you have to do in your own mind is weigh out. Because you're the one who has to live the Christian life. No one else can do that for you. You may not be willing to live as a Christian. You may not be willing to suffer for righteousness' sake. You may not be willing to erase your will and put the Lord's will there. A lot of people aren't. So you need to think about what you're willing to do and what challenge you're willing to accept. But if you accept the challenge, I promise you this, the Lord will be with you every step of the way. And He'll help you. And He'll strengthen you. And God's people will be there to back you up too. So if you need to respond to the Lord's invitation tonight, we beg you, please don't delay. Come to the front. Let me know about it. Become a Christian today. Make your life right with God, whatever you need to do at this point in time. And we'll rejoice with you. While we stand and sing.